Good morning, church. It's good to see everyone this morning. It's good, as always, to be together with God's family here at Forest Mill. And I know we have a number of people visiting with us today. I want you to know how glad we are of your presence, how thankful we are. I want you to know you're welcome back, most of you, and just about any time. No, all of you are welcome back anytime. And I'm looking forward to, I always look forward to our small groups on Sunday evenings. We've come to love the people in our group and enjoy spending that time every month with them. I hope that you are enjoying your small groups as well and getting as much out of it as we are. If you're not involved in a small group, we'd still encourage you to do that. And we can, if you would like to join a small group, we can still place you with a family and get you together with those families. It's so good to get together just to kind of share what's going on in life and do a little time of study and reflection and thinking and sharing. So really encourage you to do that. Now, we all know that when we do that, oftentimes what happens is we end up sharing some of the, not only the joys, but we share some of the hard stuff, too, that we're going through, whether it's as husband and wife, as parents, as kids, or what's going on at work or what's going on in our friendships, all those sorts of things come out. We know that bad things happen, don't we? We're aware of that. Bad things happen in life. Things go south, we might say. Sometimes people make bad decisions and the results can be, frankly, catastrophic and traumatic. Now, oftentimes, we're the ones who suffer the consequences for our own bad decisions. A lot of the times, the bad stuff that happens to us is the result of poor decisions on our part, right? Other times, though, we're just the victims of someone else's bad decisions, someone else's selfishness or greed or hatred or spite or pettiness. That's just the way it is. And as awful as those situations are, we've come to accept it. For the most part, we know that bad things are going to happen. Sometimes because of what we've done. Sometimes it's just a part of life, right? Like our health deteriorates, accidents happen, all that. We know that bad things are just a part of what it means to be human. We expect it. But sometimes, and I'll just put this caveat out there. Sometimes it's not just bad decisions and poor choices. Sometimes the enemy that we face is not ourselves, and it's not other people or our friends or our neighbors. Sometimes the enemy that we face is evil itself. That evil is a very real entity in our world. Sometimes the scary stuff of campfire stories comes to life, doesn't it? Sometimes there's something that treats other people as mere objects for their amusement or for their pleasure with no regard for other people's humanity. Something that leaves death and destruction and brokenness in the wake of its passing. Something so dark, so twisted, so powerful that nothing and no one can deal with it. No one can fix it. No one can make it right. And maybe you have encountered something like that in your life. I hope not. But odds are that we have, at some point in our life, been around or a part of a situation that was just evil itself. And when we encounter that sort of evil, it changes us as people. It changes the way we think. It changes the way we feel. We become more fearful and less trusting of other people. We begin to see threats around every corner. We begin to see dangers on our doorstep. It changes who we are as people. So we plot and we plan and we prepare. But deep down inside, we know. We know that there's really nothing we can do. Not really. So what do we do now? Now, what can we do? Now, where can we go? Where can we turn? How do we keep going knowing that there's real evil in the world? And in the Gospel of Mark, we've already seen that Jesus can deal with disease. He can deal with sickness. We've seen him casting out demons. We've even seen him last week commanding the wind and the waves. So we know there's something special about Jesus. We know that because in the wake of Jesus' passing, he leaves healing and wholeness and hope. Unlike evil, it's like the exact opposite of evil. Wherever Jesus has gone, good has been left behind, right? But there's more to Jesus' ministry than we see on the surface, right? We've talked about this earlier in the book of Mark. There's more than just what we see on the surface. Behind the scenes, there's a war going on. A war between good and evil. A war between heaven and hell. A war for the lives and hearts of humanity. It's a war over you and me. And having started this war with his arrival and beginning of his ministry, Jesus now faces a major battle for the life of one broken, deeply scarred man. And it comes from Mark chapter 5. And it's a longer account. In fact, Matthew, this is usually the exact opposite. Usually Mark is the bare bones account. I mean, he'll tell you this is what happened. And Matthew will tell you this is what else happened. But in this particular instance, Mark goes into a great deal of detail about this particular story. And I want us to read the whole thing. It's a little bit longer, but I want us to read the whole thing and just listen and sit and think and put yourself into that situation, what it would have been like to be there and witness this. Now, remember last week, Jesus and his disciples, they were on the Sea of Galilee. They were coming across. It was nighttime. Storm came up. Jesus was sleeping. They wake Jesus. The disciples wake Jesus because they're scared. They're going to drown. Water's coming into the boat and all that. Jesus wakes up and he stills the storm. He calms the wind and the waves. He tells them to be quiet. And immediately they do so. And at the end of that, we have the disciples who are looking around. They're amazed. They're overawed. They're scared to death. And they ask, what sort of man is this? This story here is meant to answer that question. Who is this Jesus that even the winds and the waves obey him? So they make it to the other side of the sea. This is what we read. Then they went across the lake to the region of the Gerasenes. When Jesus got out of the boat, a man with an impure spirit came from the tombs to meet him. This man lived in the tombs. And no one could bind him, not anymore, not even with a chain. For he had often been chained hand and foot, but he tore the chains apart and broke the irons on his feet. No one was strong enough to subdue him. Night and day among the tombs and in the hills, he would cry out and cut himself with stones. And when he saw Jesus from a distance, he ran and fell on his knees in front of him. He shouted at the top of his voice, "What do you want with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? In God's name, don't torture me." For Jesus had said to him, "Come out of this man, you impure spirit." Then Jesus asked him, "What's your name?" "My name is Legion," he replied, "for we are many." And he begged Jesus again and again not to send him out of the area. A large herd of pigs was feeding on the nearby hillside. The demon begged Jesus, "Send us among the pigs. Allow us to go into them." He gave them permission, and the impure spirits came out and went into the pigs. The herd, about 2,000 in number, that's a big herd of pigs, rushed down the steep bank and into the lake and were drowned. Now those tending the pigs ran off and reported this to the town and the countryside, and the people went out to see what happened. And when they came to Jesus, they saw the man who had been possessed by the legion of demons sitting there, dressed and in his right mind. And they were afraid. Those who had seen it told the people what had happened to the demon-possessed man and told about the pigs as well. Then the people began to plead with Jesus to leave their region. As Jesus was getting into the boat, the man who had been demon-possessed begged to go with him. Jesus did not let him, but he said, go home to your own people and tell them how much the Lord has done for you and how he's had mercy on you. So the man went away and began to tell in the Decapolis how much Jesus had done for him, and the people were amazed. Now, having safely completed their treacherous journey, stormy journey across the Sea of Galilee, the lake, Jesus and his followers arrive on the other side in a region known as the Decapolis, which literally means 10 cities. It's a Greek settled area, a Gentile area. It was the name given to this settlements to the east of the Jordan and along the eastern shore of the Sea of Galilee. Many scholars point to this particular area and near modern-day Kersey as the setting for our story. You see the steep cliffs that kind of lead down to the hillside. There's not a whole lot of places along the eastern shore that would have suit what happened, the events of this story. And there was a settlement there at one point called Gergis. It was really just a small village. And so we think that's probably what Mark was referring to. The Gerasenes, which he talks about, is like 25 miles south of the lake. Probably Mark was not as familiar with Galilean geography as some of these other contemporaries. So he might have gotten the names mixed up, or perhaps it got mixed up in the years that ensued. But anyway, most people believe this is about where it took place. Now, remember Jesus, why Jesus was here, why he came to this particular area. When he was on the western shore, the Judean side, he was being pressed in by crowds of people near Bethsaida. It's a Jewish community, Jewish settlements. And so on this other shore, Bethsaida, everybody knew Jesus had this sort of power. He was the rabbi, powerful teaching, powerful healings, powerful prophet. Who knows what all was being said about him at this point, but Jesus definitely had drawn a crowd. And so a Gentile settlement would certainly fit the bill for an area to be left alone for him, right? It would be a place where no one would care if he was a rabbi or a teacher. No one had heard of him, so nobody's seeking him out for healings. A place to just go, and he could sort of just be another anonymous face in the people over there. Nothing special, no one in particular, just go and get him. You ever have that urge to just go and be sort of left alone for a while? Well, that points to Jesus' humanity, right? I just need a little break. But while other people might have passed Jesus, we know there's nothing special about the way he looked. He didn't have one of those glowing halos like we see in the pictures around him. He was just an average-looking guy. And so when other people would pass Jesus, they wouldn't give him a second glance, not a second thought. But the battle below the surface could not ignore this incursion into enemy territory. Jesus was the Jewish Messiah, but now, for the very first time, he's moved beyond the borders of Judea, beyond the people of Judea, and it's our first hint that Jesus' mission was larger than one single nation, larger than one single people, that maybe Jesus' mission wasn't for the Jews, it was for the whole world. And so his presence is immediately noted, and he is recognized by this man who's possessed by a defiling spirit living among the tombs. And sometimes we think of graveyards, but really it would have been something more like this, just sort of living in those caves. And this spirit makes him unclean, but he's living among the dead. That would have made him unclean too. He's likely a Gentile. He's surrounded by not only undead people, I mean, by dead people. He's also got pigs everywhere. So all of that points to this being a really predominantly Gentile area, right? You couldn't have a herd of 2,000 pigs in Judea. Who's going to eat them? Who's going to touch them? Who's going to take care of them? They're unclean, right? So this is a Gentile area that Jesus is now in. And this guy, he's messed up from the feet up. I mean, there's nothing good about this situation. He's got these scars from cutting himself with stones. He's broken iron chains. Incredibly strong this demon is in him. Breaking iron chains, breaking the iron shackles off from around his ankles. Now that's impressive. And it's so messed up, so dark, that no one knew what to do about it, right? And this man immediately runs to Jesus and falls down begging for mercy. Not the typical way you begin a battle, at least not the way you'd expect. But Jesus is not a typical opponent for the forces of evil. His authority and his power are so overwhelming that they're unquestioned. When Jesus asks his name, the demons say, our name is Legion, for we are many. The idea being that there's not just one demon, that there's in fact a force. Now, Legion would have been well known because that was the name of a Roman fighting force. We might say, you know, a company or a regiment, something along those lines, right, to give us an idea of the numbers of people. And a Roman legion was about 6,000 soldiers. Now, that's not to say, and the demon's not implying, neither is Mark implying, that there were 6,000 demons, just that there was a lot, and even says so, for we're many. The idea is that there's not just one demon or two demons or a handful. There's a lot of demons here, a lot of impure spirits going here. So don't get caught up on the number. And the demon knows we may be, you know, there may be dozens or hundreds or even thousands of us, but the numbers offer no protection. And we know that the demons were strong, right? Because they were breaking iron chains and shackles. And their strength offers them no protection either, because they know that the battle that they're facing is one they can't win. They know the outcome before the battle ever starts. And so they beg. They beg for mercy. They beg not to be destroyed. They beg not to be sent out of the area. They beg to be sent into this enormous herd of pigs nearby. And surprisingly, Jesus agrees to send these demons into these pigs. Now, unfortunately for these demons, these pigs then rush down the embankment and into the Sea of Galilee, into the lake, as it's called here. Now, so I always wondered, well, what happens to the demons then? Do they like get to escape? It's like when the pig dies, it is a get-out-of-jail-free card, and they just go wander off and find some other poor, unsuspecting soul. What happens to them? Do they go into some sort of limbo? Are they just dead? What happens to the demons? And Mark doesn't specify, but based on Mark's account and Matthew's account together, there seems to be some implication that Jesus had the power to just send them somewhere out of this realm just to wait for destruction, wait for judgment. And so if that's the case, that seems to be what Jesus did here. Because the pigs rush into the sea. Remember what the sea represented? It was death. It was chaos. It was destruction. And so when the pigs drown, it's like these demons have nowhere else to go. They have to just go and await their ultimate destruction. Go and await judgment. Jesus' victory here is complete. It is final. This is not a temporary reprieve. This is not an enemy retreat. This is a complete rout. This is obliteration, annihilation in Jesus, the way Jesus has won here. So what we know is that Jesus wins, right? And you'd think everybody would be ecstatic. It would make sense if everybody was ecstatic, right? But the herdsmen and the townspeople were less, let's just say, less than hospitable, right? So they come and they see what's happened. They see this formerly screaming, cutting, strong man. And Matthew, in his account, says that this was the sort of place that nobody went near. Nobody was passing through because it was that sort of craziness going on. Did you ever live in a neighborhood where there was that house you didn't go near? You know what I'm talking about? That one crazy old guy or crazy old lady that, you know, if you walked by their house, they would come out screaming, yelling at you, and you get to the point, I'd just as soon walk the other way. And now imagine amplifying that with someone capable of what this man was capable of, living in essentially a cemetery, cutting themselves with stones. I believe you'd go a long way out of your way to not be near this particular place. And so the people come out and they see this guy who is now sitting and clothed and in his right minds, but he still bears the scars, doesn't he? I mean, he's still got the old wounds that have healed up, the fresher wounds that are maybe just scabbed over. He's still a crazy guy who lived among dead people, And they see this guy sitting here acting normal, and they see 2,000 pigs, which, by the way, was an enormous herd of pigs. That is a considerable financial investment. I've never owned that many pigs. Like, I haven't owned anywhere near that many pigs. But I'm going to go out on a limb and say 2,000 pigs today would be a considerable financial investment. Okay? And so whoever owned this, is, or the groups of people, this is their livelihood. Not just the herdsmen, the guys who looked out for it, they didn't own it. They were just hired hands. But the people who owned it, who come from the town, the guys who ran it, they've lost their jobs. And so whether it was they were concerned about the financial loss, or whether they were more concerned about the disruption to their peaceful lives, we don't know. Mark doesn't tell us. What we do know is that they allowed these distractions to blind them to what has happened here. They allow these distractions to blind them from their own desperate condition and the solution that is looking in them in the face, staring them in the eye, and sitting there with this formerly demon-possessed man. They're so concerned about the loss of pigs or the power that's been exhibited here, they're so concerned with that that they miss the opportunity to sit with the Son of God. Believe it or not, you and I know this seems so far-fetched because this is not the world we live in, right? But you and I face a very similar struggle. The Apostle Paul in Ephesians 6:12 says, "For our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the powers of this dark world, against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly realms." It can be so easy to point to those people. Those are our enemies. This is the problem. And it can be that country. It can be that leader. It can be that guy. It can be that political party. It can be this this special interest group. And we can point and say, that's the problem. There's our enemy. And you may point to, you know, a predominantly Muslim nation or a communist nation or the Democrats or to the Republicans or to these specific people who are leaders in any of those movements and say, there's the problem. That's the problem. The problem is, you know, the National Right to Life organization or the NAACP or whatever organization you think is running afoul of the Word of God and say, those people are our enemies. And the Apostle Paul says, that's not true at all. You may disagree with someone vehemently. They may be wrong. They may be making bad moral decisions. They may be living completely apart from God and doing the wrong thing, and they're still not your enemy. This man who was demon-possessed with thousands of demons was not the enemy of Jesus. Jesus' enemy was the demons that led to all this. People are not your enemy. The problem is not the people themselves, but the evil forces that drive them. And when we lose sight of that, we get into the category of thinking, yeah, all those people are the bad people. We lose sight of the fact that it's really Satan behind this whole thing that drives a wedge between humanity, between us and one another, and between us and Jesus Christ. And so Paul, the Apostle Paul, recognizes this is the real struggle. This is the real battle. This is the real fight. And it's a force. It's a show of power. And when we see it, when we come up against it and against these overwhelming odds, it is really tempting. And very often we do this. We just say, look, there's nothing I can do. That's just the way life is. And we throw up our hands and we surrender. And we're like, yes, it's terrible. It's awful. It's bad. There's nothing good in that. I don't know what to do with that. So I'm just going to wash my hands of it and walk away. I can't fix it. I don't know what to do about it. It's just bad. Here you go. I don't know what to do with it. When you encounter the Jeffrey Dahmers of this world, there's nothing good there. When you encounter the Hitlers and the Pol Pots of this world, it's just terrible. When you encounter the sort of evil that you can find on the internet in about 2 minutes, you just think, this is beyond saving, right? It can be tempting to throw up our hands and walk away and admit loss. The great American philosopher and theologian Jack Handy writes, "There used to be this bully who would demand my lunch money every day. Since I was smaller, I would give it to him. Then I decided to fight back. I started taking karate lessons. But then the karate lesson guy said I had to start paying him $5 a lesson. So I just went back to paying the bully. That can be our sort of resignation. It's easier to give in than to fight. It's easier to give up than to work. But giving up is a mistake. When we resign ourselves to loss, we are forgetting who we're fighting for and who we're fighting with. In Colossians, the Apostle Paul said this, "In this way, he," talking about Jesus, "disarmed the spiritual rulers and authorities. He shamed them publicly by his victory over them on the cross." That's who fights for us. And every person that you think is your enemy, that's who you're fighting for. Every person that you see whose life is overrun with evil and awfulness, people who are in the grips of addiction or power or greed or maliciousness or hatred or evil, those are the people we're fighting to save. Those are the people Jesus came to seek and to save, the lost. They're not your enemy. Satan is your enemy. Let us fight for the lost. Because the stories they tell, when Jesus reaches them, that's what changes the world. The people who were so lost that when Jesus found them and they began to recount that testimony, that's what changes the world. Let's fight for the lost. Let's fight with our Christ. Let's stand up to evil and with our Jesus. If we can help you in that battle this morning, won't you come as we stand and as we sing?